It's Ingrid's body. Ingrid's long, smooth legs. We're fucking in her parents' house in their living room on the couch. The TV is on, tuned to a nature documentary in which a herd of antelope is running, and then there's a parade. Claire is sitting on a tiny float in the parade, looking sad while people are cheering all around her. And suddenly, Ing jumps up and pulls a bow and arrow from behind the couch, and she shoots Claire. The arrow goes right into the TV, and Claire claps her hands to her breast like Wendy in a silent version of Peter Pan, and I leap up and I'm choking Ingrid, my hands around her throat, screaming at her. I wake up. I'm cold with sweat and my heart is pounding. I'm in the sleep lab. I wonder for a moment if there's something they're not telling me. If they can somehow watch my dreams, see my thoughts. I turn onto my side and close my eyes. I dream that Claire and I are walking through a museum. The museum is an old palace. All the paintings are in Rococo gold frames. All the other visitors are wearing tall powdered wigs and immense dresses, frock coats and breeches. They don't seem to notice us as we pass. We look at the paintings, but they aren't really paintings. They're poems. Poems somehow given physical manifestation. "Look," I say to Claire. "There's an Emily Dickinson. The heart asks pleasure first, and then excuse from pain." She stands in front of the bright yellow poem and seems to warm herself by it. We see Dante, Donne, Blake, Neruda, Bishop. Linger in a room full of Rilke, pass quickly through the Beats, and pause before Verlaine and Baudelaire. I suddenly realize that I've lost Claire. I'm walking, then running back through the galleries, and then I abruptly find her. She's standing before a poem, a tiny white poem tucked into a corner. She's weeping. As I come up behind her, I see the poem. "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take." I'm thrashing in grass. It's cold, wind rushes over me. I'm naked and cold in darkness, there's snow on the ground. I'm on my knees in the snow, blood drips onto the snow and I reach out. My God, he's bleeding. How the hell did that happen? Shit, he's ripped off all the electrodes. Help me get him back on the bed. I open my eyes. Kendrick and Dr. Larson are crouched over me. Dr. Larson looks upset and worried, but Kendrick has a jubilant smile on his face. "Did you get it?" I ask. And he replies, "It was perfect." I say, "Great," and then I pass out. 2. Sunday, October 12, 1997. Henry is 34, Claire is 26. I wake up and smell iron, and it's blood. Blood is everywhere, and Claire is curled up in the middle of it like a kitten. I shake her and she says, "No. Come on, Claire, wake up, you're bleeding." "I was dreaming." "Claire, please." She sits up. Her hands, her face, her hair are drenched in blood. Claire holds out her hand and on it reclines a tiny monster. She says simply, "He died," and bursts into tears. We sit together on the edge of the blood-soaked bed, holding each other and crying.
Monday, February 16th, 1998. Claire is 26. Henry is 34. Henry and I are just about to go out. It's a snowy afternoon, and I'm pulling on my boots when the phone rings. Henry walks down the hall and into the living room to answer it. I hear him say, "Hello?" And then, "Really?" And then, "Well, hot damn!" Then he says, "Wait, let me get some paper." And there's a long silence, punctuated once in a while with, "Wait, explain that." And I take off my boots and my coat and pad into the living room in my socks. Henry is sitting on the couch with the phone cradled in his lap like a pet, furiously taking notes. I sit down next to him and he grins at me. I look at the pad. The top of the page starts off, "Four genes, per four, timeless one, clock, new gene equals time traveler, chrome equals 17 times 2, 4, 25, 200 plus repeats tag, Sex-linked? No. Plus too many dopamine receptors, what proteins? And I realize, Kendrick has done it. He's figured it out. I can't believe it. He's done it. Now what? Henry puts down the phone, turns to me. He looks as stunned as I feel. What happens next? I ask him. He's going to clone the genes and put them into mice. What? He's going to make time-traveling mice. Then he's going to cure them. We both start to laugh at the same time, and then we are dancing, flinging each other around the room, laughing and dancing until we fall back onto the couch panting. I look over at Henry, and I wonder that on a cellular level he is so different, so other. When he's just a man in a white button-down shirt and a pea jacket whose hand feels like skin and bone in mine, a man who smiles just like a human. I always knew he was different. What does it matter? A few letters of code? But somehow it must matter, and somehow we must change it. And somewhere on the other side of the city, Dr. Kendrick is sitting in his office figuring out how to make mice that defy the rules of time. I laugh, but it's life and death. And I stop laughing and put my hand over my mouth. Intermezzo. Wednesday, August 12th, 1998. Claire is 27. Mama is asleep, finally. She sleeps in her own bed, in her own room. She has escaped from the hospital at last, only to find her room, her refuge, transformed into a hospital room. But now, she is past knowing. All night she talked, wept, laughed, yelled, called out, Philip! And Mama! And no, no, no. All night the cicadas and the tree frogs of my childhood pulsed their electric curtain of sound, and the nightlight made her skin look like beeswax, her bone hands flailing in supplication, clutching at the glass of water I held to her crusted lips. Now it is dawn. Mama's window looks out over the east. I sit in the white chair by the window, facing the bed, but not looking. Not looking at Mama so effaced in her big bed. Not looking at the pill bottles and the spoons and the glasses and the IV pole with the bag hanging obese with fluid and the blinking red LED display and the bedpan and the little kidney-shaped receptacle for vomit and the box of latex gloves, and the trash can with the biohazard warning label full of bloody syringes. I am looking out the window, toward the east. A few birds are singing. I can hear the doves that live in the wisteria waking up. The world is gray. Slowly, color leaks into it. Not rosy-fingered, but like a slowly spreading stain of blood orange. One moment lingering at the horizon, and then flooding the garden, and then golden light, and then a blue sky, and then all the colors vibrant in their assigned places. The trumpet vines, the roses, the white salvia, the marigolds, all shimmering in the new morning dew like glass. The silver birches at the edges of the woods dangle like white strings suspended from the sky. A crow flies across the grass. Its shadow flies under it, and meets it as it lands under the window and caws, once. Light finds the window and creates my hands, my body heavy in Mama's white chair. The sun is up. I close my eyes. The air conditioner purrs. I'm cold, and I get up and walk to the other window and turn it off. Now the room is silent. I walk to the bed. Mama is still. The laborious breathing that has haunted my dreams has stopped. Her mouth is open slightly, and her eyebrows are raised as though in surprise, although her eyes are closed. She could be singing. I kneel by the bed. I pull back the covers and lay my ear against her heart. Her skin is warm. Nothing. No heart beats. No blood moves. No breath inflates the sails of her lungs. Silence. I gather up her reeking, wasted body into my arms, and she is perfect. She is my own perfect, beautiful mama again, for just a moment, even as her bones jut against my breasts and her head lolls, even as her cancer-laden belly mimics fecundity, she rises up in memory, shining, laughing, released, free. Footsteps in the hall. The door opens, and Etta's voice. Claire? Oh. I lower Mama back to the pillows, smooth her nightgown, her hair. She's gone.
Saturday, September 12th, 1998. Henry is 35, Claire is 27. Lucille was the one who loved the garden. When we came to visit, Claire would walk through the front door of the Meadowlark house and straight out the back door to find Lucille, who was almost always in the garden, rain or shine. When she was well, we would find her kneeling in the beds, weeding or moving plants or feeding the roses. When she was ill, Etta and Philip would bring her downstairs wrapped in quilts and seat her in her wicker chair, sometimes by the fountain, sometimes under the pear tree where she could see Peter working, digging and pruning and grafting. When Lucille was well, she would regale us with the doings of the garden, the red-headed finches who had finally discovered the new feeder, the dahlias that had done better than expected over by the sundial, the new rose that turned out to be a horrible shade of lavender but was so vigorous that she was loath to get rid of it. One summer, Lucille and Alicia conducted an experiment. Alicia spent several hours each day practicing the cello in the garden to see if the plants would respond to the music. Lucille swore that her tomatoes had never been so plentiful, and she showed us a zucchini that was the size of my thigh. So the experiment was deemed a success, but was never repeated because it was the last summer Lucille was well enough to garden. Lucille waxed and waned with the seasons, like a plant. In the summer, when we all showed up, Lucille would rally, and the house rang with the happy shouts and pounding of Mark and Sharon's children, who tumbled like puppies in the fountain and cavorted sticky and ebullient on the lawn. Lucille was often grimy, but always elegant. She would rise to greet us, her white and copper hair in a thick coil with fat strands straggling into her face, white kidskin gardening gloves and Smith and Hawken tools thrown down as she received our hugs. Lucille and I always kissed very formally, on both cheeks, as though we were very old French countesses who hadn't seen each other in a while. She was never less than kind to me, although she could devastate her daughter with a glance. I miss her. Claire, well, miss is inadequate. Claire is bereft. Claire walks into rooms and forgets why she's there. Claire sits staring at a book without turning a page for an hour. But she doesn't cry. Claire smiles if I make a joke. Claire eats what I put in front of her. If I try to make love to her, Claire will try to go along with it. And soon I leave her alone, afraid of the docile, tearless face that seems to be miles away. I miss Lucille, but it is Claire I am bereft of. Claire, who has gone away and left me with this stranger who only looks like Claire.
Wednesday, November 26th, 1998. Claire is 27, Henry is 35. Mama's room is white and bare. All the medical paraphernalia is gone. The bed is stripped down to the mattress, which is stained and ugly in the clean room. I'm standing in front of Mama's desk. It's a heavy white formica desk, modern and strange in an otherwise feminine and delicate room, full of antique French furniture. Mama's desk stands in a little bay, windows embrace it. Morning light washes across its empty surface. The desk is locked. I have spent an hour looking for the key with no luck. I lean my elbows on the back of Mama's swivel chair and stare at the desk. Finally, I go downstairs. The living room and dining room are empty. I hear laughter in the kitchen, so I push the door open. Henry and Nell are huddled over a cluster of bowls and a pastry cloth and a rolling pin. "Easy, boy, easy. You gonna toughen 'em up, you go at 'em like that.
You need a light touch, Henry. Are they going to have a texture like bubblegum? Sorry, sorry, sorry. I will be light. Just don't whack me like that. Hey, Claire.
Henry turns around smiling, and I see that he is covered with flour. What are you making?
Croissants. I have sworn to master the art of folding pastry dough or perish in the attempt.
Rest in peace, son, says Nell, grinning.
What's up? Henry asks as Nell efficiently rolls out a ball of dough and folds it and cuts it and wraps it in waxed paper. I need to borrow Henry for a couple of minutes, Nell. Nell nods and points her rolling pin at Henry.
Come back in 15 minutes and we'll start the marinade.
Yes'm. Henry follows me upstairs. We stand in front of Mama's desk. I want to open it, and I can't find the keys.
Ah.
He darts a look at me, so quick I can't read it. Well, that's easy. Henry leaves the room and is back in minutes. He sits on the floor in front of Mama's desk, straightening out two large paperclips. He starts with the bottom left drawer, carefully probing and turning one paperclip, then sticks the other one in after it.
Voila, he says, pulling on the drawer.
It's bursting with paper. Henry opens the other four drawers without any fuss. Soon they are all gaping, their contents exposed. Notebooks, loose-leaf papers, gardening catalogs, seed packets, pens and short pencils, a checkbook, a Hershey's candy bar, a tape measure, and a number of other small items that now seem forlorn and shy in the daylight. Henry hasn't touched anything in the drawers. He looks at me. I glance at the door almost involuntarily, and Henry takes the hint. I turn to Mama's desk. The papers are in no order at all. I sit on the floor and pile the contents of a drawer in front of me. Everything with her handwriting on it, I smooth and pile on my left. Some of it is lists and notes to herself. Do not ask P about S. Or, remind Etta dinner B's Friday. There are pages and pages of doodles, spirals and squiggles, black circles, marks like the feet of birds. Some of these have a sentence or a phrase embedded in them. To part her hair with a knife. And, couldn't do it. And, if I am quiet, it will pass me by. Some sheets are poems so heavily marked and crossed out that very little remains like fragments of Sappho. Like old meat. No air. She said yes. Or, his hand to possess in extreme. Some poems have been typed. At the moment, all hope is weak and small. Music and beauty are salt in my sadness. A white void rips through my ice. Who could have said that the angel of sex was so sad? Or known desire would melt this vast winter night into a flood of darkness. 1:23:79. The spring garden. A ship of summer, swimming through my winter vision. 4:06:79. 1979 was the year Mama lost the baby and tried to kill herself. My stomach aches and my eyes blur. I know now how it was with her then. I take all of those papers and put them aside without reading any more. In another drawer, I find more recent poems. And then I find a poem addressed to me. The Garden Under Snow, for Claire. Now the garden is under snow. A blank page our footprints write on. Claire, who was never mine, but always belonged to herself. Sleeping Beauty. A crystalline blanket. This is her spring. This is her sleeping, awakening. She is waiting. Everything is waiting for a kiss. The improbable shapes of tubers, roots. I never thought. My baby, her almost face, a garden waiting.
It's almost dinner time, and I'm in Nell's way. So when she says, shouldn't you go see what your woman is up to? It seems like a good idea to go and find out. Claire is sitting on the floor in front of her mother's desk, surrounded by white and yellow papers. The desk lamp throws a pool of light around her, but her face is in shadow. Her hair a flaming copper aura. She looks up at me, holds out a piece of paper, and says, look, Henry, she wrote me a poem. As I sit beside Claire and read the poem, I forgive Lucille a little for her colossal selfishness and her monstrous dying, and I look up at Claire. It's beautiful, I say, and she nods, satisfied for a moment, that her mother really did love her. I think about my mother singing Lieder after lunch on a summer afternoon, smiling at our reflection in a shop window, twirling in a blue dress across the floor of her dressing room. She loved me. I never questioned her love. Lucille was changeable as wind. The poem Claire holds is evidence. Immutable, undeniable. A snapshot of an emotion. I look around at the pools of paper on the floor, and I'm relieved that something in this mess has risen to the surface to be Claire's lifeboat. She wrote me a poem, Claire says again in wonder. Tears are streaking down her cheeks. I put my arms around her, and she's back. My wife, Claire, safe and sound, on the shore at last after the shipwreck, weeping like a little girl whose mother is waving to her from the deck of the foundering boat. New Year's Eve, 1. Friday, December 31st, 1999, 11:55 p.m. Henry is 36, Claire is 28. Claire and I are standing on a rooftop in Wicker Park with a multitude of other hardy souls awaiting the turn of the so-called millennium. It's a clear night and not that cold. I can see my breath, and my ears and nose are a bit numb. Claire is all muffled up in her big black scarf, and her face is startlingly white in the moon and streetlight. The rooftop belongs to a couple of Claire's artist friends. Gomez and Charisse are nearby, slow dancing in parkas and mittens to music only they can hear. Everyone around us is drunkenly bantering about the canned goods they've stockpiled, the heroic measures they've taken to protect their computers from meltdown. I smile to myself, knowing that all this millennial nonsense will be completely forgotten by the time the Christmas trees are picked up off the curbs by streets and San. We're waiting for the fireworks to begin. Claire and I lean against the waist-high false front of the building and survey the city of Chicago. We're facing east, looking toward Lake Michigan. Hello, everybody, Claire says, waving her mitten at the lake at South Haven, Michigan. It's funny, she says to me. It's already the new year there. I'm sure they're all in bed. We're six stories up, and I'm surprised by how much I can see from here. Our house in Lincoln Square is somewhere to the north and west of here. Our neighborhood is quiet and dark. Downtown to the southeast is sparkling. Some of the huge buildings are decorated for Christmas, sporting green and red lights in their windows. The Sears and the Hancock stare at each other like giant robots over the heads of lesser skyscrapers. I can almost see the building I lived in when I met Claire on North Dearborn, but it's obscured by the taller, uglier building they put up a few years ago next to it. Chicago has so much excellent architecture that they feel obliged to tear some of it down now and then and erect terrible buildings just to help us all appreciate the good stuff. There isn't much traffic. Everyone wants to be somewhere at midnight, not on the road. I can hear bursts of firecrackers here and there, punctuated occasionally with gunfire from the morons who seem to forget that guns do more than make loud noises. Claire says, I'm freezing, and looks at her watch. 2 more minutes. Bursts of celebration around the neighborhood indicate that some people's watches are fast. I think about Chicago in the next century. More people, many more. Ridiculous traffic, but fewer potholes. There will be a hideous building that looks like an exploding Coke can in Grant Park. The west side will slowly rise out of poverty, and the south side will continue to decay. They'll finally tear down Wrigley Field and build an ugly megastadium. But for now, it stands blazing with light in the northeast. Gomez begins the countdown. 10, 9, 8. And we all take it up. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Happy New Year! Champagne corks pop, fireworks ignite and streak across the sky, and Claire and I dive into each other's arms. Time stands still, and I hope for better things to come. 3. Saturday, March 13th, 1999. Henry is 35, Claire is 27. Charisse and Gomez have just had their third child, Rosa Evangeline Gomolinski. We allow a week to pass, then descend on them with presents and food. Gomez answers the door. Maximilian, 3 years old, is clinging to his leg and hides his face behind Gomez's knee when we say, "Hi, Max." Joseph, more extroverted at 1, races up to Claire, babbling, "Ba, ba, ba," and burps loudly as she picks him up. Gomez rolls his eyes, and Claire laughs, and Joe laughs. And even I have to laugh at the complete chaos. Their house looks as though a glacier with a Toys R Us store inside it has moved through, leaving pools of Legos and abandoned stuffed bears. "Don't look," says Gomez. "None of this is real. We're just testing one of Charisse's virtual reality games. We call it Parenthood." "Gomez?" Charisse's voice floats out of the bedroom. "Is that Claire and Henry?" We all trot down the hall and into the bedroom. I catch a glimpse of the kitchen as we pass. A middle-aged woman is standing at the sink washing dishes. Charisse is lying in bed with the baby in her arms. The baby is asleep. She's tiny and has black hair and a sort of Aztec look about her. Max and Joe are light-haired. Charisse looks awful to me. Claire insists later that she looked wonderful. She gained a lot of weight and looks exhausted and ill. She has had a cesarean. I sit down in the chair. Claire and Gomez sit on the bed. Max clambers over to his mother and snuggles under her free arm. He stares at me and puts his thumb in his mouth. Joe is sitting on Gomez's lap. "She's beautiful," says Claire. Charisse smiles. "And you look great." "I feel like shit," says Charisse. "But I'm done. We got our girl." She strokes the baby's face and Rosa yawns and raises one tiny hand. Her eyes are dark slits. "Rosa Evangeline," Claire coos to the baby. "That's so pretty." "Gomez wanted to name her Wednesday, but I put my foot down," says Charisse.
"Well, she was born on a Thursday anyway," explains Gomez.
"Want to hold her?" Claire nods and Charisse carefully hands her daughter into Claire's arms. Seeing Claire with the baby in her arms, the reality of our miscarriages grabs me, and for a moment I feel nauseous. I hope I'm not about to time travel. The feeling retreats, and I'm left with the actuality of what we've been doing. We have been losing children. Where are they, these lost children? Wandering, hovering around, confused? "Henry, would you like to hold Rosa?" Claire asks me. I panic.
"No,"
I say too emphatically.
"I'm not feeling so hot," I explain.
I get up and walk out of the bedroom, through the kitchen and out the back door. I stand in the backyard. It's raining lightly. I stand and breathe. The back door slams. Gomez comes out and stands beside me.
"You okay?"
he asks. "I think so. I was getting claustrophobic in there."
"Yeah, I know what you mean."
We stand silently for minutes. I'm trying to remember my father holding me when I was little. All I can remember is playing games with him, running, laughing, riding around on his shoulders. I realize that Gomez is looking at me and that tears are coursing down my cheeks. I wipe my sleeve across my face. Somebody has to say something. "Don't mind me," I say. Gomez makes an awkward gesture. "I'll be right back," he says, and disappears into the house. I think he's gone for good, but he reappears with a lit cigarette in hand. I sit down on the decrepit picnic table, which is damp with rain and covered with pine needles. "It's cold out here. You guys still trying to have a kid?" I'm startled by this. until I realize that Claire probably tells Charisse everything, and Charisse probably tells Gomez nothing. Yeah. Is Claire still upset about that miscarriage? Miscarriages. Plural. We've had three. To lose one child, Mr. de Tamble, may be regarded as a misfortune. To lose three looks like carelessness. That's not really all that funny, Gomez. Sorry. Gomez does look abashed, for once. I don't want to talk about this. I have no words to talk about it, and I can barely talk about it with Claire, with Kendrick and the other doctors at whose feet we've laid our sad case. Sorry, Gomez repeats. I stand up. We better go in. Ah, they don't want us. They want to talk about girl stuff. Well then, how about those cubs? I sit down again. Shut up. Neither of us follows baseball. Gomez is pacing back and forth. I wish he would stop, or better yet, go inside. So what's the problem? He asks casually. With what, the cubs? No pitching, I'd say. No, dear library boy, not the cubs. What is the problem that is causing you and Claire to be sans enfants? That's really not any of your business, Gomez. He plunges on, unfazed. Do they even know what the problem is? Fuck off, Gomez. Tut-tut, language. Because I know this great doctor, Gomez, who specializes in fetal chromosomal disorders. Why on earth would you know expert witness? Oh, her name is Amit Montague. He continues. She's a genius. She's been on TV and won all these awards. Juries adore her. Oh, well, if juries love her, I begin sarcastically, just go and see her. Jesus, I'm trying to be helpful. I sigh. Okay, thanks. Is that thanks, we will run right out and do as you suggest, dear comrade, or thanks, now go screw yourself? I stand up, brush damp pine needles off the seat of my pants. Let's go in, I say. And we do. 4. Wednesday, July 21st, 1999, and September 8th, 1998. Henry is 36, Claire is 28. We're lying in bed. Claire is curled on her side, her back to me, and I'm curled around her, facing her back. It's about 2 in the morning, and we've just turned out the light after a long and pointless discussion of our reproductive misadventures. Now I lie pressed against Claire, my hand cupping her right breast, and I try to discern if we're in this together, or if I've been somehow left behind. Claire, I say softly into her neck. Let's adopt. I've been thinking about this for weeks, months. It seems like a brilliant escape route. We will have a baby. It'll be healthy. Claire will be healthy. We will be happy. It's the obvious answer. Claire says, but that would be fake. It would be pretending. She sits up, faces me, and I do the same. It would be a real baby and it would be ours. What's pretend about that? I'm sick of pretending. We pretend all the time. I want to really do this. We don't pretend all the time. What are you talking about? We pretend to be normal people, having normal lives. I pretend it's perfectly okay with me that you're always disappearing God knows where. You pretend everything is okay even when you almost get killed and Kendrick doesn't know what the hell to do about it. I pretend I don't care when our babies die. She's sobbing, bent double, her face covered by her hair, a curtain of silk sheltering her face. I'm tired of crying. I'm tired of watching Claire cry. I'm helpless before her tears. There's nothing I can do that will change anything. Claire, I reach out to touch her, to comfort myself, and she pushes me away. I get out of bed and grab my clothes. I dress in the bathroom. I take Claire's keys from her purse and I put on my shoes. Claire appears in the hall. Where are you going? I don't know. Henry! I walk out the door and slam it. It feels good to be outside. I can't remember where the car is. Then I see it across the street. I walk over to it and get in.
My first idea was to sleep in the car, but once I'm sitting in it, I decide to drive somewhere. The beach. I'll drive to the beach. I know that this is a terrible idea. I'm tired, I'm upset, it would be madness to drive, but I just feel like driving. The streets are empty. I start the car. It roars to life. It takes me a minute to get out of the parking space. I see Claire's face in the front window. Let her worry. For once, I don't care. I drive down Ainslie to Lincoln, cut over to Western, and drive north. It's been a while since I've been out alone in the middle of the night in the present, and I can't even remember the last time I drove a car when I didn't absolutely have to. This is nice. I speed past Rose Hill Cemetery and down the long corridor of car dealerships. I turn on the radio, punch through the presets to WLUW. They're playing Coltrane, so I crank up the volume and wind the window down. The noise, the wind, the soothing repetition of stoplights and streetlights make me calm, anesthetize me. And after a while, I kind of forget why I'm out here in the first place. At the Evanston border, I cut over to Ridge and then take Dempster to the lake. I park near the lagoon, leave the keys in the ignition, get out, and walk. It's cool and very quiet. I walk out onto the pier and stand at the end of it, looking down the shoreline at Chicago, flickering under its orange and purple sky. I'm so tired. I'm tired of thinking about death. I'm tired of sex as a means to an end. And I'm frightened of where it all might end. I don't know how much pressure I can take from Claire. What are these fetuses? These embryos, these clusters of cells we keep making and losing? What is it about them that is important enough to risk Claire's life, to tinge every day with despair? Nature is telling us to give up. Nature is saying, Henry, you're a very fucked up organism and we don't want to make any more of you. And I am ready to acquiesce. I've never seen myself in the future with a child. Even though I've spent quite a bit of time with my young self, even though I spend a lot of time with Claire as a child, I don't feel like my life is incomplete without one of my very own. No future self has ever encouraged me to keep plugging away at this. I actually broke down and asked a few weeks ago. I ran into myself in the stacks at the Newbury, a self from 2004. Are we ever going to have a baby, I asked. Myself only smiled and shrugged. You just have to live it. Sorry, he replied, smug and sympathetic. Oh, Jesus, just tell me, I cried, raising my voice as he raised his hand and disappeared. Asshole, I said loudly. And Isabel stuck her head in the security door and asked me why I was yelling in the stacks and did I realize that they could hear me in the reading room. I just don't see any way out of this. Claire is obsessed. Amit Montague encourages her. Tells her stories about miracle babies, gives her vitamin drinks that remind me of Rosemary's Baby. Maybe I could go on strike. Sure, that's it. A sex strike. I laughed to myself. The sound is swallowed by the waves gently lapping the pier. Fat chance I'd be groveling on my knees within days. My head hurts. I try to ignore it. I know it's because I'm tired. I wonder if I could sleep on the beach without anyone bothering me. It's a beautiful night. Just at this moment, I'm startled by an intense beam of light that pans across the pier and into my face, and suddenly, I'm in Kimmy's kitchen, lying on my back under her kitchen table, surrounded by the legs of chairs. Kimmy is seated in one of the chairs and is peering at me under the table. My left hip is pressing against her shoes. Hi, buddy, I say weakly. I feel like I'm about to pass out.
You gonna give me a heart attack one of these days, buddy,
Kimmy says. She prods me with her foot.
Get out from under there and put on some clothes.
I flop over and back out from under the table on my knees. Then I curl up on the linoleum and rest for a moment, gathering my wits and trying not to gag.
Henry, you okay?
She leans over me.
You want something to eat? You want some soup? I got minestrone soup. Coffee?
I shake my head.
You want to lie on the couch? You sick?
No, Kimmy, it's okay. I'll be okay. I manage to get to my knees and then to my feet. I stagger into the bedroom and open Mr. Kim's closet, which is almost empty except for a few pairs of neatly pressed jeans in various sizes, ranging from small boy to grown-up, and several crisp white shirts, my little clothing stash ready and waiting.
Dressed, I walk back to the kitchen, lean over Kimmy and give her a peck on the cheek.
What's the date?
September 8th, 1998.
Where are you from?
Next July.
We sit down at the table.
Kimmy is doing the New York Times crossword puzzle.
What's going on next July?
It's been a very cool summer. Your garden's looking good. All the tech stocks are up. You should buy some Apple stock in January. She makes a note on a piece of brown paper bag.
Okay. And you? How are you doing? How's Claire? You guys got a baby yet?
Actually, I am hungry. How about some of that soup you were mentioning?
Kimmy lumbers out of her chair and opens the fridge. She gets out a saucepan and starts to heat up some soup.
You didn't answer my question.
No news, Kimmy. No baby. Claire and I fight about it just about every waking moment. Please, don't start on me.
Kimmy has her back to me. She stirs the soup vigorously. Her back radiates chagrin.
I'm not starting on you. I just ask, okay? I'm just wondering. Sheesh.
We're silent for a few minutes. The noise of the spoon scraping the bottom of the saucepan is getting to me. I think about Claire looking out the window at me as I drove away.
Hey, Kimmy.
Hey, Henry.
How come you and Mr. Kim never had kids?
Long silence. Then,
we did have child.
You did? She pours the steaming soup into one of the Mickey Mouse bowls I loved when I was a kid. She sits down and runs her hands over her hair, smooths the white straggling hairs into the little bun at the back. Kimmy looks at me.
Eat your soup. I'll be right back.
She gets up and walks out of the kitchen, and I hear her shuffling down the plastic runner that covers the carpeting in the hall.
I eat the soup.
It's almost gone when she comes back.
Here, this is Min. She is my baby.
The photograph is black and white, blurry. In it, a young girl, perhaps 5 or 6 years old, stands in front of Mrs. Kim's building. This building. The building I grew up in. She's wearing a Catholic school uniform, smiling and holding an umbrella.
It's her first day school. She's so happy, so scared.
I study the photo. I'm afraid to ask. I look up. Kimmy is staring out the window over the river. What happened?
Oh, she died. Before you were born. She had leukemia, she died.
I suddenly remember. Did she used to sit out in a rocker in the backyard? In a red dress? Mrs. Kim stares at me, startled.
You see her?
Yes, I think so. A long time ago, when I was about 7, I was standing on the steps to the river, buck naked, and she told me I better not come into her yard, and I told her it was my yard and she didn't believe me. I couldn't figure it out. I laugh. She told me her mom was gonna spank me if I didn't go away. Kimmy laughs shakily.
Was she right, huh?
Yeah. She was just off by a few years. Kimmy smiles.
Yeah. Min, she a little firecracker. Her dad called her Miss Big Mouth. He loved her very much.
Kimmy turns her head, surreptitiously touches her hand to her eyes. I remember Mr. Kim as a taciturn man who spent most of his time sitting in his armchair watching sports on TV. What year was Min born?
1949. She died 1956. Funny, she would be a middle-aged lady with kids now, herself. She would be 49 years old. Kids would be maybe in college, maybe a little older.
Kimmy looks at me and I look back at her. We're trying, Kimmy. We're trying everything we can think of.
I didn't say nothing.
Uh-huh. Kimmy bats her eyelashes at me like she's Louise Brooks or somebody.
Hey, buddy. I'm stuck on this crossword. 9 down. Starts with K.
I watched the police divers swim out into Lake Michigan. It's an overcast morning, already very hot. I am standing on the Dempster Street Pier. There are 5 fire engines, 3 ambulances, and 7 squad cars standing on Sheridan Road with their lights blinking and flashing. There are 17 firemen and 6 paramedics. There are 14 policemen and 1 policewoman,
a short, fat white woman whose head seems squashed by her cap, who keeps saying stupid platitudes intended to comfort me until I want to push her off the pier. I'm holding Henry's clothes. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. There are 21 reporters, some of whom are TV reporters with trucks and microphones and video people, and some of whom are print reporters with photographers. There is an elderly couple hanging around the edges of the action, discreet but curious. I try not to think about the policeman's description of Henry jumping off the end of the pier, caught in the beam of the police car searchlight. I try not to think. Two new policemen come walking down the pier. They confer with some of the policemen who are already here, and then one of them, the older one, detaches and walks to me. He has a handlebar mustache, the old-fashioned kind that ends in little points. He introduces himself as Captain Michaels and asks me if I can think of any reason my husband might have wanted to take his own life. "Well, I really don't think he did, Captain. I mean, he's a very good swimmer. He's probably just swimming to, Wilmette or someplace." I wave my hand vaguely to the north. "And he'll be back any time now." The captain looks dubious. "Does he make a habit of swimming in the middle of the night?" "He's an insomniac." "Had you been arguing? Was he upset?"
"No," I lie. "Of course not."
I look out over the water. I am sure I don't sound very convincing. "I was sleeping, and he must have decided to go swimming, and he didn't want to wake me up."
"Did he leave a note?"
"No." As I rack my brains for a more realistic explanation, I hear a splash near the shore. Hallelujah. Not a moment too soon. "There he is!" Henry starts to stand up in the water, hears me yell, and ducks down again and swims to the pier. "Claire, what's going on?" I kneel on the pier. Henry looks tired and cold. I speak quietly. "They thought you drowned. One of them saw you throw yourself off the pier. They've been searching for your body for 2 hours. Henry looks worried, but also amused. "Anything to annoy the police?" All the police have clustered around me, and they are peering down at Henry silently.
"Are you Henry de Tamble?" asks the captain.
"Yes. Would you mind if I got out of the water?"
We all follow Henry to the shore, Henry swimming and the rest of us walking along beside him on the pier. He climbs out of the water and stands dripping on the beach like a wet rat. I hand him his shirt, which he uses to dry himself off. He puts on the rest of his clothes and stands calmly, waiting for the police to figure out what they want to do with him. I want to kiss him and then kill him. Or vice versa. Henry puts his arm around me. He is clammy and damp. I lean close to him for his coolness, and he leans into me for warmth. The police ask him questions. He answers them very politely. These are the Evanston police, with a few Morton Grove and Skokie police who have come by just for the heck of it. If they were Chicago police, they would know Henry, and they would arrest him.
"Why didn't you respond when the officer told you to get out of the water?"
"I was wearing earplugs, Captain."
"Earplugs?"
"To keep the water out of my ears."
Henry makes a show of digging in his pockets.
"I don't know where they got to.
I always wear earplugs when I swim."
"Why were you swimming at 3 o'clock in the morning?"
"I couldn't sleep."
And so on. Henry lies seamlessly, marshaling the facts to support his thesis. In the end, grudgingly, the police issue him a citation for swimming when the beach is officially closed. It's a $500 fine. When the police let us go, the reporters and photographers and TV cameras converge on us as we walk to the car. "No comment. Just out for a swim. Please, we would really rather not have our picture taken. Click." We finally make it to the car, which is sitting all by itself with the keys in it on Sheridan Road. I start the ignition and roll down my window. The police and the reporters and the elderly couple are all standing on the grass watching us. We are not looking at each other.
"Claire."
"Henry."
"I'm sorry."
Me too. He looks over at me, touches my hand on the steering wheel. We drive home in silence. Friday, January 14th, 2000. Claire is 28, Henry is 36. Kendrick leads us through a maze of carpeted, drywalled, acoustical-tiled hallways and into a conference room. There are no windows, only blue carpet, and a long, polished black table surrounded by padded swivel chairs. There's a whiteboard and a few magic markers, a clock over the door, and a coffee urn with cups, cream, and sugar ready beside it. Kendrick and I sit at the table, but Henry paces around the room. Kendrick takes off his glasses and massages the sides of his small nose with his fingers. The door opens, and a young Hispanic man in surgical scrubs wheels a cart into the room. On the cart is a cage covered with a cloth. "Where do you want it?" the young man asks, and Kendrick says, "Just leave the whole cart, if you don't mind." And the man shrugs and leaves. Kendrick walks to the door and turns a knob, and the lights dim to twilight. I can barely see Henry standing next to the cage. Kendrick walks to him and silently removes the cloth. The smell of cedar wafts from the cage. I stand and stare into it. I don't see anything but the core of a roll of toilet paper, some food bowls, a water bottle, an exercise wheel, fluffy cedar chips. Kendrick opens the top of the cage and reaches in, scoops out something small and white. Henry and I crowd around, staring at the tiny mouse that sits blinking on Kendrick's palm. Kendrick takes a tiny penlight out of his pocket, turns it on, and rapidly flashes it over the mouse. The mouse tenses, and then it is gone. "Wow," I say. Kendrick places the cloth back over the cage and turns the lights up. "It's being published in next week's issue of Nature," he says, smiling. "It's the lead article." "Congratulations," Henry says. He glances at the clock. "How long are they usually gone, and where do they go?" Kendrick gestures at the urn, and we both nod. "They tend to be gone about 10 minutes or so," he says, pouring 3 cups of coffee as he speaks and handing us each one. "They go to the animal lab in the basement where they were born. They don't seem to be able to go more than a few minutes either way." Henry nods. "They'll go longer as they get older." "Yes, that's been true so far." "How did you do it?" I ask Kendrick. I still can't quite believe that he has done it. Kendrick blows on his coffee and takes a sip, makes a face. The coffee is bitter, and I add sugar to mine. "Well," he says, "it helped a lot that Celera has been sequencing the whole mouse genome. It told us where to look for the 4 genes we were targeting. But we could have done it without that. We started by cloning your genes and then used enzymes to snip out the damaged portions of DNA. Then we took those pieces and snuck them into mouse embryos at the 4 cell division stage. That was the easy part." Henry raises his eyebrows. "Sure, of course. Claire and I do that all the time in our kitchen. So what was the hard part?" He sits on the table and sets his coffee beside him. In the cage, I can hear the squeaking of the exercise wheel. Kendrick glances at me. "The hard part was getting the dams, the mother mice, to carry the altered mice to term. They kept dying, hemorrhaging to death." Henry looks very alarmed. "The mothers died?" Kendrick nods. "The mothers died, and the babies died. We couldn't figure it out, so we started watching them around the clock, and then we saw what was going on. The embryos were traveling out of their dam's womb and then in again, and the mothers bled to death internally. Or they would just abort the fetus at the 10-day mark. It was very frustrating." Henry and I exchange looks and then look away. "We can relate to that," I tell Kendrick. "Yes," he says. "But we solved the problem." "How?" Henry asks. "We decided that it might be an immune reaction. Something about the fetal mice was so foreign that the dam's immune systems were trying to fight them, as though they were a virus or something. So we suppressed the dam's immune systems, and then it all worked like magic." My heart is beating in my ears. Like magic.
Kendrick suddenly stoops and grabs for something on the floor.
Gotcha, he says, displaying the mouse in his cupped hands.
Bravo, Henry says. What's next?
Gene therapy, Kendrick tells him. Drugs.
He shrugs. Even though we can make it happen, we still don't know why it happens, or how it happens. So we try to understand that. He offers Henry the mouse. Henry cups his hands and Kendrick tips the mouse into them. Henry inspects it curiously.
It has a tattoo, he says. It's the only way we can keep track of them, Kendrick tells him. They drive the animal lab technicians nuts. They're always escaping.
Henry laughs. That's our Darwinian advantage, he says. We escape. He strokes the mouse, and it shits on his palm.
Zero tolerance for stress, says Kendrick, and puts the mouse back in its cage, where it flees into the toilet paper core.
As soon as we get home, I am on the phone to Dr. Montague, babbling about immunosuppressants and internal bleeding. She listens carefully, and then tells me to come in next week, and in the meantime she will do some research. I put down the phone, and Henry regards me nervously over the Times business section. It's worth a try, I tell him.
Lots of dead mouse moms before they figured it out, Henry says.
But it worked. Kendrick made it work. Henry just says,
yeah,
and goes back to reading. I open my mouth and then change my mind and walk out to the studio, too excited to argue. It worked like magic. Like magic.
5. Thursday, May 11th, 2000. Henry is 39, Claire is 28. I'm walking down Clark Street in late spring 2000. There's nothing too remarkable about this. It's a lovely warm evening in Andersonville, and all the fashionable youth are sitting at little tables drinking fancy cold coffee at Copi's, or just strolling, ignoring the Swedish knick-knack stores and exclaiming over each other's dogs. I should be at work in 2002, but oh well. Matt'll have to cover for my afternoon show and tell, I guess. I make a mental note to take him out to dinner. As I idle along, I unexpectedly see Claire across the street. She's standing in front of George's, the vintage clothing store, looking at a display of baby clothes. Even her back is wistful. Even her shoulders sigh with longing. As I watch her, she leans her forehead against the shop window and stands there, dejected. I cross the street, dodging a UPS van and a Volvo, and stand behind her. Claire looks up, startled, and sees my reflection in the glass.
Oh, it's you,
she says and turns.
I thought you were at the movies with Gomez.
Claire seems a little defensive, a little guilty, as though I've caught her doing something illicit. I probably am. I'm supposed to be at work, actually, in 2002. Claire smiles. She looks tired. And I do the dates in my head and realize that our fifth miscarriage was 3 weeks ago. I hesitate, and then I put my arms around her. And to my relief, she relaxes against me, leans her head on my shoulder. How are you? I ask.
Terrible,
she says softly.
Tired.
I remember. She stayed in bed for weeks.
Henry, I quit.
She watches me, trying to gauge my reaction to this, weighing her intention against my knowledge.
I give up.
It isn't going to happen. Is there anything to stop me from giving her what she needs? I can't think of a single reason not to tell her. I stand and rack my brain for anything that would preclude Claire knowing. All I remember is her certainty, which I am about to create. Persevere, Claire.
What?
Hang in there. In my present, we have a baby. Claire closes her eyes, whispers,
thank you.
I don't know if she's talking to me or to God. Doesn't matter.
Thank you,
she says again, looking at me, talking to me. And I feel as though I'm an angel in some demented version of the Annunciation. I lean over and kiss her. I can feel resolve, joy, purpose coursing through Claire. I remember the tiny head full of black hair crowning between Claire's legs, and I marvel at how this moment creates that miracle and vice versa. Thank you. Thank you. Did you know?